Now, the name Alan Johnson, the name Alan Johnson is very familiar to people like me because I'm actually a social work teacher. And anybody involved with social policy and the concern for marginalised people will have come across the name Alan Johnson on numerous occasions. And I think many of you will be familiar with the fact that for 12 years, Alan was the author of the Salvation Army's State of the Nation, which was an absolute treasure trove for those of us interested in the state, the social policy state, the marginalised communities, things that really touch our practical work as training social workers and also our research work. So for 12 years, Alan was the author of a remarkable work, really. And the most recent one was issued, February this year, I think, from memory. So he comes with extraordinary credentials. And also involved, I think, with Child Poverty Action Group. Is that correct, Alan? Child Poverty Action Group has got a number of academics, actually, including one of my colleagues in social work, Mike O'Brien. And I think Innes Asher, from memory, is involved with it as well. So here is Alan, who was a keen... He's actually, I think, originally trained as a planner, in fact, or an urban economist planner person. So he brings with his passion for these subjects a great deal of academic ability in analysing what's going on in our country. And he's got a lot to say, which is worth listening to. So currently we have a new environment for Alan. He's recently left the Salvation Army, where he was a policy analyst, and he's now the title Principal Policy Analyst for the Ministry for the Environment. And I thought that one of the Green Party people was minister, but apparently it's actually David Parker. So I've learnt something today. So, Alan, it's a pleasure to welcome you and listen to what you have to say. If you like to have a little clicker, you're welcome.
Cheers.
It's right there. Well, what's happened to the data predictor? Oh, of course. Press to show. Coming up. Okay, that's good.
Do you want to lapel mic?
Can people hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'll speak loudly.
Is it coming? Oh, there we go.
Oh, Ngā mihi nui, kia koutou katoa, kia koe whae i whakawhitai ahau, i whakawhitai ana ahau, kia koe mō tō waiata mō tō karakia, kia ora mai ana. Hi everybody, I'm Alan Johnson, and this is a guy called, and those of us, I don't even remember him, I'm not that old, but perhaps some people remember. He was Lyndon Baines Johnson, and one of the quotes I once heard from him, he said, he didn't know much about poverty because where he grew up in East Texas, everyone was so poor they didn't know there was a name for it. And he had something of a remarkable career. He started off as a high school teacher and teaching mainly poor Hispanic children in the east of Texas, and he rose, as you know, to become the president of the US. And he's known for two things, really, the Vietnam War and the War on Poverty. He's more known for the Vietnam War than for the War on Poverty. And in 1968, when he was seeking his re-election, because, of course, he followed on from John Kennedy in terms of being the vice president, stepped into his shoes, and then he was elected in 1964 as the president. He was due for a second term, but he was so discouraged by the fact that he wasn't even picking up support of his own party serving president, he basically resigned from the campaign. And this was the last speech he ever made in public. And I think it's worth just reciting, because I think it's really, it's got some really powerful rhetoric, which I think is important that we think about. And he said, "We know there's injustice, we know there's intolerance, we know there's discrimination and hate and suspicion, and we know there is division among us, but there is a larger truth. We have proved that great progress is possible, and we know how much still remains to be done. And if our efforts continue, and if our will is strong, and if our hearts are right, and if courage remains our constant companion, then, my fellow Americans, I am confident we shall overcome." And, of course, That phrase, "we shall overcome," was borrowed from the civil rights movement. Here was a white Southern Democrat using the rhetoric and the language of the civil rights movement. And this was massively important for the framing of that civil rights movement and for his presidency. And I think it's really important because I think that idea of a larger truth is something that we should always hope for and believe in. Anyway, basically what I want to do is borrow all my ideas from two political philosophers. Alistair McIntyre, who is clearly the guy on the left, and Martha Nussbaum, who is an American political philosopher, who is a woman on the right. And I've read something of some of them, and I expect many of you have read of them as well. And I think they really offer us some really great insights as to where we might go as a society in terms of a moral compass. And it's sort of something that I've been quite interested in trying to get a handle on. Because, you know, if we think about how we are to reinvent, for example, our welfare state, I don't think we start with ideas of what's the best policy setting and how to incentivise people to behave properly. I think we start with what it is to look after each other. But the welfare state was created in 1938, and it was created by a group of Christian socialists, and they used their reference to the Gospels as the basis of their moral compass. Well, those times are long past. And we've now, I think, got to look for another moral compass in the time when, in some respects, we're quite immoral as a society. And so, well, I'm quite interested in this as an idea. And I think the politics or the policies and politics of kindness fit into that really well. And so, I'm going to use their ideas and sort of draw from them to see where we might go. And I believe the politics of kindness, if we were to use the instruction of McIntyre and Nussbaum, involves three strategies. One is that we need to abandon the liberal rationalism that has been so pervasive for the last 30 years and even longer, and instead recognising the place of virtue and emotion in our public life and our lives as well, you know, just in terms of our lives and in our public life. So we focus on virtue and emotion. The second is that we use public resources to nurture public love. That there is a strong role for the state and its various guises to do this. This isn't something incidental that's simply left to civil society. This is something that we consciously do as a society, and we use the power of the state to do that. And the third is that we consciously combat fear, envy, and shame. Because I think those are the enemies of love. So these are the three strategies, and I'll sort of cover those things in a very summary way. Abandoning liberal rationalism. In his seminal book called After Virtue, Alistair McIntyre said this: "The passions of some are to be preferred to the passions of others. Whose passions reign? The preferences of those who accept the stability of property, of those who believe that the passage of time confers legitimacy upon what was originally acquired by violence and aggression. Hume thus provides an underpinning for an attempt to claim universal rational authority for what is in fact the local morality of parts of 18th century Northern Europe." And I think it's really important to appreciate where the basis of our moral compass comes from. It largely comes from a particular part of the world in a particular time. But it's been presented as being universally rational. I think we really do need to challenge that. And he said, "It is therefore after all the case that the crucial moral opposition is between liberal individualism in some version or other and the Aristotelian tradition in some version or other." And I wrote a paper, and I think it is on the Salvation Army website, which looks at Aristotle, Christ, and Mills as being the basis of some moral positions. And in some respects, we've gone full circle. We went from Aristotle to Christ or to Christian teachings and into the liberals and libertarians. And McIntyre suggests that we need to go back to Aristotle and in particular focus on virtue. And so this is something that's not recent, but it's taking a long time, I think, to gain an ascendancy in ideas. Martha Nussbaum, of course, works more pragmatically on the level of politics, and she said, "I envisage a type of liberalism that is not morally neutral, that it has a certain moral content predominantly, including equal respect for persons, a commitment to equal liberties of speech, association and conscience, and a set of fundamental social and economic entitlements." And I think it's a fundamental set of social and economic entitlements that we've got to hang on to. It's easy to talk about freedoms of speech and association, but it's the other part of being a citizen and being part of a national community that's important to hang on to. So she builds a lot on, particularly in her work on political emotions, and she's written another book called Forgiveness, Anger and Forgiveness, which I've just finished reading. So the rebirth of virtue ethics. As I said, virtue ethics have made a comeback after like 2,000 years of being in the wilderness under the shadow of Christianity and then liberal thinking. And its offering, I believe, is sort of a direction for our moral compass, but it hasn't actually been completed. And it's a difficult piece of work. Has anyone read McIntyre? It's a difficult piece of work. I find philosophy really difficult. I never studied philosophy, but it fascinates me. But he reiterates it several times. I was looking at the book last night again, and he reiterates, and he says, really, the way forward and out of our liberal rationalism involves three elements. That we should focus on personal excellence, that whatever we do it as well as we can. He said that an ideal society has people trying to do the best they can as individuals. And in some respects, too, that relies on us ensuring that other people can do the best they can as well. And so whatever it is you do, whether you're a policy analyst for the Ministry for the Environment or a lecturer or someone who works with your hands, you do it as best you can. The second thing is that we have a shared narrative of a worthwhile life. That when we start to talk about what it is to be a New Zealander, we have an idea of what that is. It's not in esoterical, vague terms, it's very specific. And we say, this person to me represents a worthwhile life. And I think we had that with Sir Edmund Hillary, but we've lost it subsequently. And I saw a picture of a former Prime Minister in a magazine just yesterday, and I looked at him and I thought, why on earth is your life being judged to be worthwhile? There was nothing in his life, in my view, that justifies it being worthwhile. And yet his life is now being presented, I think, and framed as this worthwhile life. And I think we need to really consciously look at the people whose lives we think are worthwhile and elevate those things. And that's one of the points I come to at the end. And finally, McIntyre says that we should develop or have a shared moral tradition about the things in our culture which are shared and which have a moral basis to them. And he suggested that shared moral tradition is unique to every society. It's not, there is not a universal one. There's one that exists with New Zealand, Aotearoa, one that exists elsewhere as well. So for me, those are the three key organising ideas as we look forward. Nussbaum has done quite a lot of work on this idea of public love. And in particular, she talks and she compares the work or the thinking of Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Nelson Mandela. And she says this attitude can be called love so long as we understand that Gandhi and King refer to an attitude that is not soft and sentimental, but tough and uncompromising in its demand for justice, the word justice. It is an attitude of respect and active concern that seeks a common good in which all are included. And I would suggest to you that if we're starting to think about kindness, the things that we need to think about are things like justice, like respect, active concern, not just a passive concern, and that we are working towards a common good. And for me, and Nussbaum, and I'd genuinely recommend that you read her. She's a little philosophical, but she's a little very conceptual in some of her ideas, but she's really looking for practical political responses to things. Anyway, one of the things that she does talk about in Anger and Forgiveness is the work and the thinking of Martin Luther, of Nelson Mandela. And she labels part of it as what she calls a strange generosity. As you know, Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in prison. And there are stories that she tells that are retold from biographies of Mandela about the relationships he struck up with his guards and the respect he thought he should show them. And as he spent 27 years in jail, he had the opportunity clearly to contemplate. And he probably developed this idea of non-anger, this idea of not being angry. But Nussbaum talks about this idea of anger. And I think as we think about kindness, we've got to think about anger. And if you think about anger, and if you think about when you've been hurt or harmed, and the anger you often feel about the injustice or the pain that you feel about that thing, then I think you get to a point that you realise that hanging on to that anger is not going to do anything for your future. And Nussbaum calls it a transition, that you go through a transitional anger and then you realise that anger has no role into the future, into your future or into societal future. Mandela came up with that conclusion very quickly. He said, well, the best way to go through transitional anger is go through it very quickly and to avoid even getting angry in the first place. And when he became the president of South Africa, and of course they set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, what was interesting about that is that it wasn't about getting justice. It wasn't about getting even or retribution or making people pay for what they did. It was simply an attempt to expose the reality or the history to the light of day and to use that exposure, that admission of harm that's been caused both by people or to people as a point of reconciliation. And so what's interesting, and Desmond Tutu tried to, because he was involved in the Reconciliation Commission as well, tried to claim a Christian sort of cloak for that. And Nussbaum, who is Jewish, suggested that wasn't the case. And she spent a lot of time, and this is what led me into reading it, there's the idea of forgiveness. And she said that this idea of Christian forgiveness isn't particularly helpful. And she also looks at the Jewish idea of forgiveness, which is marginally more helpful than the Christian one. By background, I'm a Catholic. And so we have a lot of emphasis in our rituals around forgiveness. But it's a basic forgiveness that you first got to admit your sinfulness, then you've got to ask for forgiveness. You've got to express real sorrow for what you've done. And it's essentially putting yourself at the mercy and at the control of somebody else, the confessor or the person of harm. And Nussbaum and Mandela sort of said, well, no, that's not how you reconcile. You don't reconcile by getting the person that has hurt you or harmed you to be minimised, to whakaiti, you know, to be made small. And one of the things that Mandela realised is that the future for South Africa involved white people as well as black people and mixed race people. And that he really needed to make certain that his opponents were were future partners. And I think that's a really strong idea, that the people that you think are oppositional actually are your partners. It's the only way it worked. And so part of the reconciliation was that there was no resentment or bitterness. There was no revenge, although, you know, many members of the ANC sought to do that. Mandela had the mana to ensure that this was really just about opening up the truth. And Nussbaum says that this idea of non-anger is a psychological and emotional practice that we have to work on as individuals, and that by doing that as individuals, we can think about how we do that as a society, that we work on ways in which we can minimise the anger that as a society we feel. And if you look at media, even if you look at today, I bet you there's articles in the media that are going to make people angry, right? And they're deliberately there to make them angry. And I think we need to start to change that. We need to start to say there is no point in getting angry about someone who's committed a terrible crime, partly because it wasn't you that were hurt, it was somebody else, but partly because that anger is not going to solve anything. You know, not to suggest that the person doesn't deserve that anger, but that collective anger is not helpful. Anyway, this is what Mandela's sorts of strand was, that firstly there was an acknowledgement of wrongdoing, that the people who committed you know, particularly the security force, that committed terrible crimes against black people, actually came out and publicly admitted they'd done it. Then there was a reconciliation. There was an attempt to build relationships that hadn't existed before. And out of that reconciliation came growing empathy. And out of that growing empathy came increasing trust. And out of that increasing trust came a mutual respect. And I know, you know, you look at South Africa today, it's you know, there's a massive problem. I've never been there, but there's massive, well, what I've seen are massive problems to do with poverty and inequality. The fact is that it's a neoliberal state, like many others. So some of the fundamental political structures weren't changed. But either way, it's a more coherent state than possibly most people would have predicted post-apartheid. And one of the things, and this is a really symbolic photo, Nelson Mandela, at the time of the Rugby World Cup in 1995, you might remember it, the All Blacks were meant to win and they didn't. And the South Africa, the Springboks won, and Mandela dressed up in a Springbok jersey. This was like dressing up in the clothing of your oppressors. And he came on, and he had quite a lot to do with the Springboks during that time. And the comments of Francois Pienaar, who was the captain of the time, said that he rang him up and he was talking to him about the team. He took an active interest in the team. And actually, in fact, and Francois Pienaar gave a tribute at his funeral and cried. This is a guy that represented the white Afrikaners actually being embraced. And apparently, at the Rugby World Cup, 65,000 sports fans who were mainly white Afrikaners all called out Mandela's name. He was their leader as well. It's a transformation. And it was very symbolic. And I think this is part of what we need to think about. Where's the symbolism in our public life that represents this sort of love, this sort of reconciliation? Because we need to think about it. You might think about the mosque shootings, and I'm going to get onto that soon. But Nussbaum says that morality cannot survive in a world where anxiety is unrelieved by trust and love, that genuine concern for others rests on a capacity of empathetic understanding and a sense that the other's perspective matters. So you can't, if we're anxious, if we don't have trust and love in our relationships, both individually and collectively, then we are not going to develop a morality that's going to be enduring. And she suggests that the basis of nurturing public love involves conscious efforts by the state and civil society, including the following: political rhetoric, the language we use, and you know, the reason I cited Lyndon Baines Johnson initially is because I thought that rhetoric was amazing. So the language we use, and we might think the Prime Minister done very well with the rhetoric that she's offered post mosque shootings, through public ceremonies and rituals, through songs and poems, through symbols. You know, the song that we heard previously was an example of that. It was an expression of a history of a whakapapa, of a story. And it was important that it was placed at the beginning, so it placed us in this place. That we have art and architecture, that we design of public buildings and monuments, public sports and public education are all the things, the avenues you use to build this public love. And I'll use an example, which for me, I spent many sleepless nights watching the Black Cats playing rugby in the Cricket World Cup. And in particular, this guy, Carlos Braithwaite, if you followed the game, he batted, he more or less saved West Indies from an embarrassing defeat, and he batted for most of the innings. And he had to get six off the last ball to win. He hit a six and it went right to the boundary and was caught right on the boundary by Trent Bolt. And he sucked to his knees and started to cry. The massive effort he'd made to try and win that game, and it came down to the last ball right on the boundary, and he lost. And he sunk to his knees and cried. And Ross Taylor, amongst others, went up and embraced him. They were jubilant that they'd won the game, but they understood his pain. And this is what he said: New Zealanders are some of the best people in the world to share a dressing room or to play against, you know? And I just thought, if that's the reputation we can develop as a country, that some of the best people in the world, you know, that care about others, that don't believe somehow that the sport or the game or the thing of today is the only thing that matters. And I think that's an example which we should use of public sport and the way in which we offer public love. Literally, there's public love. You know, this guy's coming and say, "You're right, mate. We know you're hurting right now. We feel for you." And then Nussbaum moves on to talk about what we can do in education. And interestingly, she talks about patriotism. And you go, why on earth would an American liberal talk about patriotism? And she says, actually, there's the value of patriotism is because it wraps the idea of public up, public love up with the idea of nation state. That if there is a purpose or a centre point for our public love, it's our country. And she said, you've got to be very careful that that's not misused, because it can be. But she says that, that firstly, we need to teach our children to care about their nation and its history, right? We need to genuinely, rather than be dismissive and say that we're this terrible country that was born of these terrible injustices, and you know, we're all the people who came in and were dreadful, and all the people who were oppressed were still oppressed, and all that. You could tell those stories, and I should. But the reality is, there's a bigger thing there too. You know, just yesterday I was talking to my colleagues about Auckland. I'm a native Aucklander, born under the shadow of Mangakeke, right? And I said, I love Auckland. I think it's the best place in the world. Mm-hmm. I just wish it could be better. And I wish I could contribute to it. And I have a real affinity. I love this place. I just love it. My ancestors have been here for 160 years, and I just feel as though, for me, it's part of me. And we need to teach our children that that's part of being a New Zealander, whether you've recently arrived or whether you've been here for 1,000 years. I think we need to teach critical thinking, not just as a skill, but as a pedagogy, as a way of teaching, that we use positional imagination. And by that, she means that you do role plays, and sometimes you play the person who's the outsider, so that you can understand what it's like to be the outsider. So you build empathy for the outsider, because sometimes you're the outsider. That you discuss past wars, that you don't demonise them, but you're honest with them. And one of the things that disturbs me greatly about Anzac Day is the militarism that surrounds it. And in particular, the First World War was a war, it was an imperialist war. And we're celebrating it still. And the worst, frankly, the worst people are getting the most notice. And I just think it makes me very uncomfortable. And you know, that's our national celebration of an imperialist war that had nothing to do with us. You know, 10 years before the First World War, the Germans were our cousins, and then all of a sudden they're our enemies. Remember? And the Kaiser and the King were cousins, literally cousins, and they were fighting each other. They were the enemy. You're crazy stuff. And I think, too, that we need to teach a love for historical truth as a way of avoiding misplaced values, that we need to say, this is what really happened. Let's not kid ourselves, Wahi. Let's not brush over the land wars and the genocide and those things. Let's not suggest that it didn't happen, because it did. And we're having this debate about whether or not we should talk about the land wars, and many are saying, oh, we shouldn't. And many are saying, yeah, we should, because in many respects it happened right here, right where we stand. One of the things, and I've used this slide before, and I'm going to use it again because it fits in, but the image on the left is the Japanese surrender of Tokyo Bay and 2nd of September 1945. My dad was there as an 18-year-old. He was an 18-year-old sailor, volunteered for the Royal New Zealand Navy, and fought in the Pacific as a teenager. And he visited Nagasaki subsequently and saw all the destruction. And from what I can understand, because I never talked to him about it, but from letters he wrote home to his mother, he was devastated by it. He was devastated by the suffering of the Japanese. And that, to him and his generation, profoundly influenced that generation. And I would suggest that for my generation, the thing that profoundly influenced us was the Springbok Tour. That this was a period of considerable unrest in New Zealand's history. And it was motivated by a number of factors, some of which was about racism, but some of which was just about having a go at the cops. And the thing was with the Springbok Tour is it highlighted for Pākehā that the racist nature of their own society. Okay, all of a sudden Pākehā were exposed, because Māori and Pākehā were protesting, but they weren't necessarily protesting about the same thing. And Māori said, hang on a minute, you guys, you think this is great? You think somehow that the apartheid in South Africa is not sort of repeated in here as well? Oh, yeah, they said, Pākehā said, yeah, right. And I think there was a generation of people who then started to reconsider the basis of the basic understandings of New Zealand society. But then we have the lost shootings. And I think we've gone back to understanding the racist nature of our society. So a generation and a bit later, not much has changed. And you go, how on earth can that be? that we had a generation of people who really fundamentally started to understand the racist nature of society, and then then 35 years or 30, you know, 38 years later, we have this dreadful violence, and all of a sudden we're shocked by it, and we somehow believe it's not us. And I think it is. I mean, as I was just saying to a colleague of mine who I had a coffee with today, it's not us. It is indeed us. It's the murder of brown people, of coloured people by white people. It's the thing that happened before, and it's still us. And so unless we acknowledge that, we're not going to move forward. And I think it's important that we don't labour that and get overwhelmed by Pākehā guilt, but it's important to acknowledge it. Immanuel Kant, who is a grim Prussian philosopher that lived in the 18th century, many of you are probably familiar with him, but he wondered about this idea of why people were sometimes behave badly. You know, it's all very well to talk about kindness, but we know people behave badly, and why is that? Is it innate in our character to behave badly? And if we're interested in a society where people treat each other with kindness, we need to understand the nature and the source of bad behaviour. Nussbaum suggests that bad behaviour is partly nurtured in infancy and partly structured into the society. And our nurtured inclinations are then reinforced by the society. And a key mechanism she suggests for this is this idea of projective disgust, that we quickly learn to split the world of humans into favoured and stigmatised. The people who we love and the people who we don't know and loathe. And she said, this is a real enemy to compassion and love. And her response to and some of that was to avoid hierarchies, that if we think about way people and groups are victimised, we form hierarchies, we're at the top and they're at the bottom. And in particular, we encourage collective thinking and you know, mob rule and groupthink, and so what we should do in response to that is to encourage dissent. Now we move on to John Rawls. John Rawls and others have called for a society based on what they call political liberalism, the idea that society actually is quite heterogeneous, that it's a very mixed society, and that public institutions and civic culture should not be based on values and frameworks of the dominant group. And in this idea of political liberalism, religion certainly doesn't have a place, okay? But Nussbaum asks, how can such a pluralist liberal society, and I quote, have enough substance and texture to be capable of the type of poetry, oratory and art that moves people? Because much of this stuff is really based in a set of values and experiences. You just don't, you know, the former Prime Minister that I was talking about before, I doubt could compose any decent poetry. And it's simply because it's probably not in his character and his experience. Maybe I'm wrong. But if you think about the poetry that really moves you, it comes from a special place. And she said, if you have this broad, pluralist society where nothing in particular is of special, then what makes the things that we value? You know, what creates those things? In answer to such a challenge, she suggests that we have a civic culture based on political liberalism, which needs to be both narrow and thin. Narrow in that it doesn't comment on every aspect of human life, but only some of them, and in particular the things around social and economic rights. So our political culture really, and I was talking to someone today, why do we talk about drug reform? What on earth, and you know, I'm showing my colours here, why on earth do we criminalise people who use drugs and then not worry about whether or not they've got enough to eat? You know, we had that moral panic over the methamphetamine contamination of state houses, and people thrown out of state houses because they're contaminated and they're unhealthy. We didn't worry about what happened to them after they threw them out, whether or not they had a place to stay. We were more worried about the moral panic of their behaviour. And I think part of the idea is that we have a political agenda that is quite thin and narrow. It's thin insofar as it doesn't look to be concerned about all the metaphysical questions of life, such as is there an afterlife, what's the meaning of life. It is very much focused on the here and now, and we leave those metaphysical things for people to work out for themselves. And her hope is for a culture that will develop with overlapping consensus, that there's enough at the core that people who have reasonable views of politics, not unreasonable ones, can actually find something in common in that core. And I think as an idea, I think it's something that's a useful place to start. I don't think it's necessarily easy to bring about. And finally, I just want to offer the following ideas. They are somewhat disparate, and I just suggest that we might start with these. That we need to build a shared moral discourse, and from this a tradition based on virtues which we think define our New Zealandness, right? Our Aotearoa-ness, our Aotearoa-tanga. And I think kindness, empathy and generosity of spirit can genuinely be included in that. I think we have the basis for that within our cultural traditions. No? And so I don't think we can just say, look, let's be kind because it's an idea. Well, I think we could say, let's be kinder because we already are kind. But certainly we could be kinder. Let's exemplify this moral tradition with examples of lives of New Zealanders who have shown generosity and kindness. Not by people who have shown self-servingness and greed, but by those who have shown generosity and kindness. And I think that example will be inspiring to us. Let's physically build civic interaction and utilise the spaces we have for a richer communal life. So we spend time together as a community. The real problem is that when you hop in your car and drive home, you can go from the parking garage downstairs to the flick up the car door and drive into the car, you never see anyone. Well, you see people, but you never interact. I catch the train, I don't talk to many people on the train, but you'll mix it, there's that interaction with people which is a whole lot more, and it creates a whole lot more opportunities than this private space. And I think we need to acknowledge our history without chagrin, guilt or bitterness, and reflect on why and how we celebrate or ignore that history. Why is it that we celebrate an imperialist war of 100 years ago but ignore the sort of imperialist wars that provided the sort of property rights of the current of the nation we have now? Why is that? We really need to look at that. And I think we need to make sure that we see anger as a block to our future and that we recognise all, as Mandela did, we recognise all our fellow countrymen and women as partners in that future. And we don't see them as being outside of that. Mike, I've got to take off, but I could take a couple of questions. I've got to catch a plane in a couple of hours.